Well, I'm Ron Delachiezer. Welcome to a very special edition of our Jazz Songbook here on WGBH 89.7 in Boston, and we're streaming worldwide, WGBH.org. That theme by Arthur Fiedler and the Boston Pops Orchestra served to introduce a gentleman who I had the pleasure of knowing and who thousands and thousands of people listened to. His name was Gene Shepherd, and Gene reigned supreme in radio for many, many years, then went on to do a television series for PBS and perhaps is best known worldwide for A Christmas Story. And with us tonight to talk about his passion and love for Gene Shepherd is the man who wrote the book. It's called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd by Eugene B. Bergman, published by Applause. And Gene, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about your favorite subject.
It's a pleasure to be here. I haven't stopped talking about him in years.
I remember, like yesterday, when you called me and you said, Ron, I'm going to do a book on Gene Shepherd. And I said something like, well, that's like climbing Mount Everest, because the man truly was an enigma and yet a great artist. Many people consider Gene Shepherd to be the Mark Twain, James Thurber of his day, the guru of night talk radio, who was so unique. How did you discover Gene?
When I was a sophomore in college, a fellow student said to me, hey, have you heard this fantastic guy that talks late at night on the radio? And he told me about Gene Shepherd. And eventually I started listening when, in 1956. He was on Sunday nights from 9 to 1 at that point. And I was just totally captivated. My parents would be in the living room watching television, and I'd be two rooms away in the kitchen listening to Shepherd, just sitting there enthralled.
He had the ability to pull you in. You heard about him through somebody else. I discovered him by accident, and about the same time when I was scanning, you know, the radio late at night, and I heard this voice, this disembodied voice. He wasn't playing any music. He was just talking, and he was talking, and he was talking. And I said, who is this guy? I can't imagine anybody on radio doing this. And I was hooked in. Gene, you were nice enough to bring some sound bites of Gene Shepherd. So for those members of the audience, who perhaps have never heard Gene Shepherd, and we're always bringing in new people into the cult of Gene Shepherd, especially now with your book, Excelsior, You Fathead. This is one of the earliest moments of Shepherd on the air, isn't it? This one we're going to play. Hurling an invective.
Yes, it is. It's from 1957, and in fact, I recorded it originally.
Can't speak to me. WOR, looking at it realistically, has realized that we must, nay, indeed, all of us, you must have an outlet. You must be able to, from time to time, tell them what it's all about. Give it to them. Don't stand still for nobody. Once again, the science of electronics brings deeper and richer meaning to your lives. Put your radio on the windowsill. In an unprecedented act of goodwill towards its listenership, realization of its deep responsibilities as a purveyor of public good, WOR makes this service available to you exclusively. This is the only station where you'll find an outlet for your aggressions. You'll find expressions for your repressions. Put your radio on the windowsill now. Do it now. Now. With the loudspeaker pointed out towards the neighborhood. You know that crowd out there. You know that gang. Of course you do. Put it out there. That's it. And I'll give you a cue. And the WOR Public Service Department stands behind you. It's okay. Nobody will be able to trace it to you. We have a special, non-traceable voice which we use on this particular invective. It's all right. It will not sound like any living being. Any resemblance to anyone alive at this time is purely coincidental. It does not, of course, include you, since you are obviously not coincidental, nor the result of forces beyond all comprehension. Millions of tiny forces have led you to this point. Coincidences here and there, yes, but they've all fallen into a pattern, and here you are now. So you're off the hook. This voice will carry your sentiments, your repressions, your aggressions, into the darkness out there, that void where they're lying in wait. Those sharks are waiting. Your friends, yeah, your friends. They're your friends, all right. They're your friends. Anytime you really need them, you know what's going to happen, of course. All right. Get your radio out on the windowsill and point it outwards, and I'll give you the cue. And when I give you the cue, turn that radio up as loudly as it'll go. We're going to use a very special kind of invective tonight. This is known as the disquieting with a touch of morbid curiosity type, which is type 23A and a very difficult type to use. You can drop out now if you feel it's a little too strong. It's the... All right, all ready? Okay. Radio on windowsill now. Turn it up. Okay, turn it all the way up. Turn it up. Lights out, for heaven's sakes, turn your lights out. Turn the radio on now. Turn it up. Pretend that you're looking at television. Pretend you're asleep. Okay?
Myrtle! This is the third time you've come home drunk again! What about the kids? What about the kids, I ask you? How long is this going to go on? How long?
Okay, get that radio back in now, fast. This is the Martin Block program. It's time for make-believe pool room, friends and neighbors. Time to pick up your cues. Time to step over the table and knock off a game of make-believe snooker. And now on table seven.
Wow, that's the beginning of hurling invectives in the night, and that's from a 1957, very early Gene Shepherd show. And Eugene Bergman was nice enough to bring it in conjunction with his book, Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. And he is with us on this very special edition of our songbook on WGBH in Boston. Gene, by the way, spells it with a G, right? Gene,
I do,
yeah, the
yes.
Gene, spell it with a J. That can you imagine, like in 1957, listening to that coming out of your radio, with this guy who, as you said, if you had never heard about him, or listening to him for the first time, you say this guy's either out of his mind or he's a genius, right?
Right, and of course I knew he was a genius, and it was just extraordinary every Sunday night to be able to turn that program on, and for 4 hours listening to him extemporize, knowing that he wasn't reading from a script, having the feeling that he was talking just to me, as tens of thousands of other listeners had the feeling that he was talking just to them. And it was quite a quality that he had, an intimate feeling, and a feeling that he was giving you everything about himself and doing it at a very high intellectual level.
By the way, that hurling invective concept later showed up in a movie. Paddy Chayefsky wrote the screenplay called Network.
Yes,
right?
And Shepherd claims that Paddy Chayefsky asked him if he could make use of that reference in the movie. It has to do with a TV newscaster who's in the middle of a nervous breakdown, and he tells his audience to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to your windows and yell out, I can't take it anymore, or words to that effect. Well, this is obviously a Shepherd technique.
We're gonna, one of the nice things about Gene Shepherd and reading your book, Excelsior, You Fathead, brings back memories for those special shows that we remember about Gene, and the variety of music he was able to incorporate into his show. I'd like to play one of my favorite moments in the Shepherd lexicon was when Gene picked up the kazoo and played Hindustan. We have a little bit of that right now. We're going to play for you. This is Freewheeling Gene Shepherd.
Rest our tired caravan. Yeah. Hindustan. Yes, sirree. Where the painted peacock proudly spread his fan. Woohoo! Boy. Hindustan. Where the purple sunbird flashed across the sand.
Hey, that's nice.
Hindustan, baby. Where I met her and the world began.
All right, bring it up there. Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah. Oh, Hindustan. Where the purple sunbird flashed across the sand.
That's only the first verse, though. There's more to it than that.
Hindustan, classic Shepherd from one of his shows. Gene Berman is here. Bergman is here with us, who wrote the book, Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd, published by Applause. One of the things you did was put together Shepherdisms, things that he created, things that philosophical concepts that became unique in Gene Shepherd's time. Hurling invectives we just heard into the night. Keep your knees loose, another one. Flick lives, going back to his days in Indiana with his pal named Flick. Excelsior, you fathead. Excelsior, by the way, is our understanding of Latin meaning onward and upward. Creeping meatballism, that happens to be one of my favorites. But all of these things that Gene talked about and were unique in what he was to radio, right?
Yes, they were. He really enjoyed the medium of radio, which is made up of sound, but the kind of sounds that music is, and his little attempts at all kinds of reproduction of a motorboat or a car backfiring. He loved to do those things with his mouth. In one of the excerpts we heard, you could hear him pounding on his desk. Well, that was not accidental. He loved the idea of you being able to hear him pound at his desk or rattle some pieces of paper. So he used sound as a medium, and he used words, and he just loved using words, and you couldn't stop him from using words.
He was also a great lover of jazz, as we know, and incorporated jazz as a background to a lot of what he was doing in terms of the free-form improvisation, stream of consciousness things he was doing on the air. And he was very partial to the jazz of the 20s, like we're listening in the background to Jelly Roll Morton, and he would frequently weave his improvisations over the music, right?
Yes, he did. That was one of the interesting things. He became, in a sense, a jazz performer interacting with the musicians on the record.
Let's listen to a little bit of this. This is a segment that Gene would use at times on his show. This is Jelly Roll Morton, and this gives you a sense of the feel of the music that Gene Shepherd used. Called Dead End Blues, and that's the kind of music that Gene Shepherd would use on his nightly radio show. And I was thinking, Shepard never identified the music he was playing, right?
No. Occasionally on his very early shows he would, and he'd play more extended pieces. But by the time he really got into the period most people are familiar with, especially from 1960 to 77, he would just use them as background and as a way to interact with his words. It's interesting that Shepard, what most people don't realize if they're only familiar with the later Shepard, is how deeply he was involved in the jazz field. He was the MC for some major, major concerts in the late 50s. Concerts with Billie Holiday, Stan Getz, Charles Mingus. He MC'd those concerts. I was fortunate I saw one of them in Central Park that starred Billie Holiday. He also wrote a column on jazz for Audio Magazine. So this was not just a casual thing on his part. He was deeply into it.
No question about it. And he was also writing a lot at this time. He was writing for Playboy. He interviewed Coleman Hawkins, a lot of other great jazz musicians, and even did the first interview with the Beatles, I believe.
Well, Playboy sent him over to the British Isles for a week to follow the Beatles around and do the interview. It appeared in February 65.
Eugene Bergman, our guest, author of Excelsior, You Fatted, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard. This book is available, by the way, at Amazon.com, right? Through Amazon.com?
Absolutely.
Also at Borders Books in Boston. And where
Barnes
else?
Barnes & Noble.
And Barnes & Noble has it, too.
And the Harvard Coop.
Harvard Coop. We're going to get back and listen to more of some of the moments from Gene Shepard's radio broadcast through the years. And these are from the personal collection of Gene Bergman's, by the way, that we're privileged to be able to share with you on this special edition of our Jazz Songbook on WGBH in Boston. And this, again, starts with a little bit of Gene's theme, which was the Bonfrey by Strauss.
By Edward Strauss.
Not to be confused with Johann, right?
Right. As Shepard used to say, one of the lesser Strausses.
At least I'm back. Holy smokes. You know, this is terrible. I'm still so shaken by this whole thing that I hope we've already got a few advance reports. Please do not call them into the station here because for some reason or other, our entire switchboard system has been, it's been just knocked completely out of kilter. So perhaps this... you know, could have some kind of electronic ramifications that we don't even know yet about. There's all kinds of scientists and that crawling around here. And we would like to hear, you know, what actually occurred in your area. We had one report, which I do not credit, that a young man was listening to the, just before the news when we did the scientific experiment with the Dyack curse. A young man was listening in, I believe the town was... West Orange. Is there such a town as West Orange, New Jersey? Well, he was listening in West Orange. His father demanded that he turn this jazz off, which is the way it was put. The old man apparently used his own nomenclature to describe the show. He says, turn that jazz off. And the kid got into an argument with the old man, and before they could get to the radio, both of them fled the house screaming, trailing smoke. We don't know what the further ramifications have been. We'd just like to know. You know, speaking, we've got to clear the air. It's just too much. You know, you get too close to the primal guts of life, and you got to clear the air. Would you please help me clear the air there, Mario? Please, bring it on.
He was born with
oh,
wings as great
oh my gang. Let's go, crowd.
A lucky star.
A lucky star. Oh,
guides him.
Lucky keep your old nose down, keep your feet up. Oh, lucky Lindy. Keep an eye on the track. Watch out, man. Look out for that old red line. Oh, lucky. That's the bubble. Lucky Lindy flapping him old wings. Oh, let's go, gang.
Together,
again.
Oh, lucky Lindy.
Lucky, lucky.
You're flying across the ocean.
Lucky old Lindy.
For a long sweetheart.
Oh, baby.
Lucky you're not in the ship.
I'm always just me and my shadow. Oh, lucky Lindy.
Please show me what that was.
Liz, an example of the freewheeling, I don't give a damn shepherd, early shepherd from the late 50s, right, Gene?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Lucky Lindy, you know, he had this feeling for that music of the 20s and 30s that seemed to enhance what he was doing.
He did. It's interesting that some of the music that he enjoyed, in a way, he loved it, and in a way, he would call it glop. You know, so there were many things like that, poetry, music, that he would both love and hate and love to hate and get a kick out of playing anyway, no matter what anyone thought.
One of the things you do in the book is you talk a lot about Shepherd and his artistry. You transcribed a lot of his shows so that when you're reading the book, you feel like you're listening to him. You really captured that, I think. And you interviewed a lot of people that were important at different stages in Gene's life.
Yes, I managed to get a hold of quite a few people, a number of people who knew him in the 50s, which was such an important part of his creative life when he arrived in New York City and began broadcasting there. And he wrote 23 short stories in Playboy, and I managed to interview Hugh Hefner. I was also very pleased that I got to talk for about 40 minutes to U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins, who listened to Shepherd when he was growing up. And Billy Collins said, every night, I had to get my Shepherd fix. And he told me he couldn't imagine growing up without Shepherd. I mean, that's quite a statement from a U.S. Poet Laureate.
You take us into the television world of Gene Shepherd, which, of course, involves WGBH, because I had the pleasure of meeting him. When he came in the early 70s, he did his radio show, a live radio show here. And the engineer for that show is a good friend of mine, Matt Johnson, who remembers it. And then, of course, with the relationship with Fred Barzyk, who brought him into public television. That's all a part of your book.
Yes. Fred told me that he knew of Shepherd because one of the local stations up here was playing him, and he felt that he just had to get Shep up on GBH television. Fred said that, they used to be doing naval instruction manual type shows on GBH.
I remember those.
And so he managed to get Shepherd up. He paid him $1. And he got Shepherd out on the dock and long cable to the TV camera and said to Shepherd, you've got a half an hour. Do whatever you want. So as Barzyk puts it, in place of one of those instructional video type programs, on would come this wild guy, Gene Shepherd.
See, I'm walking along. I'm just paying attention only to my own world. I'm walking along on 16th Street the other day and just reading signs. There are those of us who read signs, and then there are those who apparently never see this world around us. One of the most significant signs here in New York is a sign that flashes M-O-N-Y. Off and on, M-O-N-Y. You know that I was in New York for over 3 months before I realized that that wasn't a misspelling? It's true. I had no idea what this meant. And I just thought, well, it's New York, you know? And I used to walk up and down Broadway at 2 o'clock in the morning, and that thing would go M-O-N-Y. I just said, why doesn't somebody get that thing fixed? This is beginning to bug me. M-O-N-Y.
M-O-N-Y. It would just flash, and then it would go M-O-N-Y. 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 And underneath it, it would say 314. 315 M-O-N-Y. And then there would be a little yellow pole or something. And there would be a green star at the top. M-O-N-Y. And I'm walking along Broadway trying to figure out why aren't they getting that thing fixed. Everybody is seeing it all over town, this misspelling. It's awful. So either you look at it or you don't. You know, I find that most people don't, and those who don't always figure that those who do are a little bit out of their minds. What's this young man speaking about? Well, I'm walking along 16th Street the other day. Madam, how do you feel this one? I'm walking along 16th Street on the west side, and I notice in through one of the doorways, you know, there's the little ante room or the lobby into one of these office buildings where there's the automatic elevator that goes up and down, and there's this big directory hanging in there with all the little white letters, and it tells where everything is. And then there's usually two or three big signs that say barber shop to the right or coffee shop to the left, or there's an arrow that points and says telephones that way. Has it ever occurred to you that one of the major industries of New York is telephoning? Honestly, it really is. One of the major industries here in New York City is just plain telephoning. I don't mean getting anything done about it. I mean just telephoning. There's always a line of people standing in front of a telephone booth telephoning. If you could somehow get a corner on that market, if you could collect 1 cent on every one of these don't worry, somebody is. Excuse me, madam. I can't help it, you know. Don't feel sorry for the phone company. They have little itsy-bitsy pink phones now that light up in the dark. I can see Wallace Beery. He rushes into this room to make a phone call. Some disaster has happened, and he grabs a hold of this little itsy bitsy, this little Jonquil yellow phone, the one that lights up in the dark. He's trying to dial it, and his finger can't fit into the.
Come on, man, now, come on, man. What's the matter with this phone?
And his finger's caught in the dial. Excuse me, madam. So I'm walking along 16th Street, and I look in there. There's a big sign that says coffee shop, and there's another big sign that says barber shop that way. And then above it, there's a sign that says the Margaret Sanger Bureau. And there's a great big blue and white sign, and all it says is fertility, one flight up. Well, I saw that one, and I walked on a little ways, and then this is beginning to soak down into my consciousness. You begin to understand the nature of our fears. Who would like to shoot an arrow into the air with me? I mean, you know, not worry much about where it lands. You know, just up it goes. M-O-N-Y. 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 316. Well, I suspect that. Speaking of secrets, we have with us today the Village Voice.
Bring it up.
That's another excerpt from one of the Gene Shepherd shows from the late 50s, in what we like to refer to as his free-form period. Our guest on this special edition of the Songbook, the man who wrote the definitive book about Gene Shepherd. And the book is called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd, published by Applause, by Eugene B. Bergman. When you listen to that, you realize what he was talking about, the telephones, but he was way ahead. Look at now. I mean, you know, nobody's going into a booth anymore. Everybody's talking on a cell phone, right?
Right.
One of the things about Shepherd was he had this uncanny ability to look ahead, didn't he? And predict things.
He did. And one of the ways he did that was that he felt that there were lots of times very small indicators of what was going to happen in the culture. He would call these cracks in the sidewalk. In other words, here was this little bitty crack that maybe most people wouldn't pay attention to, but you didn't know what was going on underneath the surface that might have been much more significant. So he would like to point these things out and say that don't just think that trivia and these little bitty news notes that he loved were nothing, that they very possibly were indicators of big social movements. So he would indeed be able to predict with amusing regularity.
So many firsts for Gene Shepherd. The first worldwide live commentary of a World Series was Gene, right?
Yes. He did that for the Armed Forces Network. They asked him to go out to Yankee Stadium for the World Series and broadcast a portion of each game. So he claimed it was the first satellite worldwide broadcasting of a World Series.
John Cassavetes, tell us about the relationship with Cassavetes.
Well, Cassavetes was one of the very, very few guests who came on his show. This was sometime in the late 50s. Cassavetes was supposedly there to promote his acting in the film Edge of the City. But instead what he did was suggest that he could make a better movie than the one he had just acted in, and that he that obviously the producers hoped people would go see. And he said, if only people would give me a little money, I could make a better movie. And surprisingly, Gene Shepherd listeners sent in about $2,000 to help Cassavetes. And it was enough for Cassavetes to rent camera equipment, buy some film, and using his improvisational class of actors to film his first independent film, Shadows. And in fact, one of the opening credits says, presented by Gene Shepherd's Night People. Now, that's quite a tribute to Shepherd. He basically helped Cassavetes start the whole American independent film industry.
Our guest on this special edition of our songbook is Eugene Bergman, who came up from New York to join us and talk about his book, Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd, who, of course, was also a star of public television. We're going to get into that a bit later on, and also share more of the art and enigma of Gene Shepherd. By the way, the book is available at Barnes & Noble and also at Borders and through Amazon.com. And you're listening to WGBH 89.7, where Boston's arts and culture station, and NPR, online at WGBH.org worldwide, also broadcasting on WNCK 89.5 Nantucket.
Yeah, say by the way.
Oh, by the way.
When we meet,
when we meet,
when we meet,
when we meet,
we'll say,
Papa, 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 Papa.
Yes, sir,
that's my baby.
No, sir,
I don't mean maybe.
Yes, sir,
that's my baby now.
Oh,
baby, let's sing it out, King.
You're singing well tonight, Art. That was excellent.
Gene Shepherd. You know, I keep calling you Gene, and it's interesting, your first name is Gene, too. Gene Bergman, who wrote the book, Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd, spelled with a J-E-A-N. These kind of free-form things that he was putting together, when he'd pick up the jew's harp and the kazoo, and then he got into head-thumping, which he described as, he had a term for that.
Well, it's called Kopfspielen.
Kopfspielen.
Pardon my pronunciation. But he could actually thump out a tune by knocking on his head and using the mouth cavity as the chamber for the sound. And, of course, it wasn't exactly in tune, but with the rhythm and somewhat of the highs and the lows of the notes, you could actually recognize the song. He claimed that he had a several octave range, and he could play chords and hold a long note, which is all just absurd. And he once actually played what he referred to as a concerto to some Mozart. So he quite often got a kick out of being in a silly mood, and he could do all kinds of wild stuff.
He would create things, too. He also, when he was in Carnegie Hall, he appeared there, and he had everybody bring a kazoo, right?
Actually, he gave them out.
He gave
them out to everybody, and he taught them how to play it, and then he held a mass kazoo playing of the Sheik of Araby.
We're going to play now one of Shepherd's most famous jazz recordings, and it became a classic when he collaborated with bassist Charlie Mingus, and they made a recording in the 50s called The Clown for Atlantic, and it's been reissued on CD. But as you mentioned, Mingus would listen to Shepherd like so many others, musicians in New York, and that's how he discovered Gene, right?
Yes, they were good friends. They used to go over each other's house and became quite friendly for a while.
That's how this started, and it started as an improvisational piece, right?
Yes.
Let's listen to it.
This clown, and he was a real happy guy, a real happy guy. He had all these greens and all these yellows and all these oranges bubbling around inside him, and he had just one thing he wanted in this world. He just wanted to make people laugh. That's all he wanted out of this world. He was a real happy guy. Let me tell you about this clown. He used to raise a sweat every night out on that stage and just wouldn't stop. That's how hard he worked. He was trying to make people laugh. used to have this cute little gimmick where he had a seal follow him up and down a stepladder. Blowing Columbia the Gem of the Ocean on a B-flat Sears Roebuck Model 1322A plastic bugle. A real cute act. But they didn't laugh. Oh, you know, a few little things here and there, but not really. And he was booking out in all these tank towns, playing the Rotary Club and the Kiwanis Club and the American Legion Hall. And he just wasn't making it. And he had all these wonderful things going on inside of him, all these greens and yellows and all these oranges. He's a real happy guy. And all he wanted to do was to make people laugh. That's all he wanted out of this world, was to make people laugh. And then something began to grow. Something that just wasn't good began to grow inside of this guy. Funny thing. And something began to trouble this clown. You know, little things. Little things once in a while would happen that would make that crowd begin to move. But they were never the right things. Like, for example, the time the seal got sick on the stage, all over the stage, and the crowd just broke up. You know? Little things like that. And they weren't supposed to be in the act, and they weren't supposed to be funny. This began to trouble him, began to bother him. This little thing began to grow inside. All those greens and all those oranges, all those yellows, they just weren't as bright as they used to be. And all he wanted to do was to make that crowd laugh. That's all he wanted to do. There was this one night in Dubuque when he was playing this Rotary Club. All these dentists and all these druggists, all these postmen sitting around, and they were a real cold bunch. Nothing was happening. He was leaving the stage when he stumbled over his ladder and fell flat on his face, just flat on his face. And he stands up, he's got this bloody nose. He looks out at the crowd, and that crowd is just rolling on the floor. He's just knocked them flat out. This begins to trouble him even more. And he begins to see something. Thank you. Began to change, but really change. Not the least of which, our clown changed his act. Bought himself a set of football pads, a yellow helmet with red stripes. Hired a girl who dropped a 5-pound sack of flour on his head every night from maybe 20 feet up. Oh man, what a bit. That just broke him up every night. But not like Dubuque. And all those colors, all those yellows, all those reds, all those oranges, a lot of gray in there now, a lot of blue. And all he wanted to do was to make this crowd laugh. It's all he wanted out of this world. They were laughing, all right. Not like Dubuque, but they were laughing. And the dough started to come in. He was playing the big towns, Chicago, Detroit. And then it was Pittsburgh one night. Real fine town, Pittsburgh, you know. About three-quarters way through his act, a rope broke. Down came the backdrop, right on the back of the neck. And he went flat. And something broke. This was it. It hurt way down deep inside. He tried to get up. He looked out at the audience. And you should have seen that crowd. They was rolling in the aisles. This was bigger than Dubuque. This was bigger than Dubuque. He really had him going. Well, this was it. This was the last one. This was the last one. This was the last one. He knew now. Man, he really knew now. But it was too late. And all he wanted was to make this crowd laugh. Well, they were laughing. But now he knew. That was the end of the clown. And you should have seen the bookings coming. Man, his agent was on the phone for 24 hours. The Palladium. MCA. William Morris. But it was too late. He really knew now. He really knew. He really knew now. William Morris sends regrets.
Well, you talk about being innovative. That's a collaborative effort between Gene Shepherd and Charlie Mingus, the clown. Recording they made, was it the late 50s, 57?
57. Mm-hmm.
57. And you can understand after you listen to that, it's been reissued on CD, by the way, why Mingus and other jazz musicians found sustenance in what Gene was doing on the radio with this kind of free-form improvisation, where they actually did that in the studio. Amazing recording. We're here on our songbook tonight with Eugene Bergman, author of Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. It's published by Applause. One of the things that... Gene was a multi-talented individual. It wasn't just radio, but later on, of course, he became best known for Christmas Story, which has become an annual classic, like A Christmas Carol and other great classics. It's a station that's run all day and all night.
Right. Turner Network plays it 24 hours straight, starting at 8 p.m. on Christmas Eve. And it's said that one year, Variety magazine reported that 38.4 million people had heard and watched at least a portion of it that year. It's just amazingly popular. It's a very, very funny, very good movie. And a lot of people think of it, of the whole movie, and have this nostalgic feeling about, oh, the good old days. But actually, most of the bits in it, the hilarious bits, have their downside. Poor friend Flick, who gets his tongue stuck on a cold metal pole. My favorite is where the... finally, after the kid tells Santa Claus that he wants a BB gun for Christmas, and Santa Claus says, "Hey, kid, you'll shoot your eye out," Santa Claus pushes the kid down the chute with his big black boot right in the kid's face. I mean, this is not your typical nostalgia. It's a very funny bit.
What's interesting, too, is that it came late in Gene's career that he had this great success. He had been around a long time, to those of us who knew them and the people who were listening to his radio shows, and then the PBS series produced by Fred Barzyk, Gene Shepherd's America. The Christmas Story, everything just clicked for him. And as you say in your book, he became filthy rich at last.
Right.
That was the title of one of the PBS shows on Gene yes. Shepherd's America.
Yes, it was. Yeah. And he loved the fact that he was into movies and that he'd made this movie, and he was very happy that he became filthy rich at last. One of the things that made him bitter, though, was his technique of his adult voice narrating the entire movie was picked up by the TV sitcom The Wonder Years.
Right, exactly.
The story is that he... had been thought of as being that narrative voice on The Wonder Years, but something happened and they decided that he wasn't so easy to get along with, and they chose somebody else, and he was rather bitter about that.
Now I'm with you, sweet mama.
My baby.
Buck, 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 buck. I mean money, mama. I'm with you, sweet mama. As long as you have...
Yeah, what you do is you knit one first and then you purl two.
And after that, you just sit down and wait for developments. It's like opening up a box of one of these instant pudding mixes and so on. You always have the hope. It's a very fugitive, sneaking hope. Almost a, well, it's a hope that you beat down with mental sticks and stones. A fugitive, sneaking hope that when you mix the water with it and mix the milk with it, that instead of pudding, something else will suddenly leap out of the bowl. A great hissing and bubbling. And, you know, boy, that immense feeling of power. That's what we want, power, all of us. Let's admit it, we want power. I admitted it last week. Somebody called up and said, "What do you want, Shepherd?" And I suddenly sat here for a moment and thought about it. What do I want? Once in a while, one has to face oneself clearly and distinctly. What do I want? And then I came to the answer that struck me like a thunderclap, a great cloud out of the west that rolled and hissed and steamed. I want everything. Everything. That's what I want. All the money, everything. I want everything. Everything. I want everything. All the women, everything. I want every radio show. I don't want anybody else to have any shows. I want every television show. Me, starring me. I want to do every show on Broadway. Well, and then I admitted it. And this guy called up again and says, "Oh, quit clowning around, Shepherd. What do you really want?" And he couldn't face the fact that I had told him what I really wanted. You see, we keep ducking and bobbing behind this silly, shilly-shally facade of wishful dreams. Okay, you got it. It's right out in front of you now. And all its hairy virility, right out there. And you can't hide from it, ever, really. Did I ever tell you about this guy I knew who had a Model A? A Model A Ford. And he had it perfectly restored. It was a beautiful Model A Ford. Well, it was. It had a bad muffler. But it was a Model A Ford. And he had imitation snakeskin upholstery put in it. It was terrible. And he thought it was good. And I remember he drove this pretty little Model A Ford around. He said to me, "Isn't this great? Look at this imitation snakeskin upholstery." And all I could think of to say was, "Your muffler's bad." See, I couldn't face it either. Not the grim, shrill reality of life. Grim. Well, it's not so grim. Ever tell you about the time Charlie Grimm got mad and threw his banjo out of the third base dugout in Wrigley Field? And then went all the way out in the right center field. This banjo. It was a tenor banjo, I remember. And then Grimm saw this tenor banjo out in right center field, and he suddenly got panicky and realized that it was the only tenor banjo on the north side of Chicago. And it was his chief earns of means of livelihood. And so he called time. And the umpire was about ready to throw him out of the park, you see, for what he had done. And Charlie went up to him and said, "It slipped. I was just practicing a few swings in the dugout. It slipped." Well, actually, he was having a tantrum that he wouldn't face up to. He was having what we call in the business a banjo tantrum. Or it's known by the psychological...
Another brief excerpt from Gene Shepherd's radio show in the late 50s from Gene Bergman's collection. And we want to talk a bit about the end, because it was not really a happy ending, was it, Gene, to his life?
No, he in his last years became increasingly bitter that he had not made it bigger than he had. Of course, he was extremely successful. He was the great innovator of talk radio. He made some good films. He did some extraordinary television work. He wrote a lot of really good humorous short stories. And most people would have been deliriously happy with that kind of career. But he wanted more.
I think that the thing that I knew, and my wife and I knew Gene and his beloved Lee, was how much Lee, his wife, Lee Brown Shepherd, meant to him in terms of everything. She produced his shows. She took care of all of his correspondence. She helped write his screenplays.
They lived in Sanibel Island, and they also had a home in Waterville, Maine. And as this started to happen, this dark period, of course, Lee became ill, and she predeceased him. And many people believe, and I believe, and also I think you do too, that he literally died of a broken heart.
Yes, that's what a number of people told me. He just really fell apart. He became more and more isolated. If you managed to get through to him on the phone, you could tell that, as someone said, he sounded like a broken man.
Well, you've captured so much about him in your book. And again, I want to thank you for coming up from New York to join us tonight on this first hour of our program, The Past Hour, in which we paid tribute to Gene Shepard. You can't really do it in an hour. It requires many hours to pay tribute to Shepard, because that's what he was all about. He was somebody who took extended solos. I feel like a jazz musician. He would go on for chorus after chorus after chorus and build these elements into his show. But I must say, you've captured so much of what he was all about. And doing this book, I know, was a great labor of love for you, because Shepard, as you said in your book, in the title of your book, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard. And he was an enigma, wasn't he?
He definitely was. And, you know, I wouldn't have done this book for the money. I did it out of love of what he had given to me and what I believe he gave to American culture.
The title of the book, again, Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard by Eugene B. Bergman.